broke into the Baptist church in Colburn. Imagine with me, if you will, how did young John get into that church after hours? Did he pick a lock? Did he break a window? And more importantly, why? Why was it worth the gamble, the consequences of getting caught and getting in trouble, which he did? The details are sketchy. We don't know what happened in that little church. What we do know is this: John's curiosity had gotten the best of him. He just wanted to know what the organ sounded like. And we also know this: he's been breaking into churches ever since. Not just that little Baptist church, but the Anglican church. Parishes like St. Peter's, Brimley Road, St. Thomas Huron Street, and wherever else they'd pay him to play the organ. The National Church with the hymn book task force. The Mormon Church, where he spent his 20s, drawn in by their sense of belonging and their missionary zeal. John broke into churches that would welcome him and churches that wouldn't. And then he broke into this one. When John first interviewed for the organist job here in 1984, he didn't get it. It went to someone else. But as luck would have it, it didn't work out for the other guy, and when the job was open again 6 months later, John came back. He's been breaking into Church of the Redeemer for over 30 years. When I say that John had a habit of breaking into churches, what I mean is this. He had a way of sneaking in, watching and listening from his seat at the organ, and noticing everything, the needs, the possibilities, and little by little, he broke down our notions of how things used to be done, how things have to be done. And little by little, he challenged us to imagine how things might be done or how things could be done in new and inspired ways. I believe that John's unfailing spirit of liturgical and musical innovation was driven by that same curiosity that made him break into that little church all those years ago. What would it sound like? I think it was also rooted in a profound faith in God. Everything John did was grounded in his deep faith. Now, you might not have guessed this. He wasn't one just to break into prayer during a conversation. But everything he did was by the grace of God and to the glory of God. In the words of his beloved Bach, "I play the notes as they are written, but it is God who makes the music. I play the notes as they are written, but it is God who makes the music." John really believed that, and he shared that belief with all of us. We might be singing the notes, but it's God who's making the music. And that's why John always did everything he could to get us to sing along. We had Mosey out front wearing his coat to teach us a tune. Upper voices on this side, lower voices on this side, and he'd delight in having it all come together. It wasn't so much that John needed to hear us singing. It was that he wanted us to hear God making music in us. John spent the last 35 years loving us. Now, you might not have known that just from looking at him. He had a stern, resting face. You were never quite sure if that was a half frown or a half grin hiding under that mustache. And I suppose it could be said, with all great respect, that every now and again he could come across music that he heaped his love and care on us, on all of us, and on each of us. I want to say more about how John loved us, but first I want to acknowledge where I believe his love was anchored, in his abiding relationship with Paul, his beloved spouse and partner of 39 years. Together, the two of you have been a source of welcome and warmth and nurture for so many of us over the years. Paul, there was a particular tenderness and joy in John's voice that I heard only when he spoke of you. Just before Christmas this year, when he was in hospital, he said to me with tears in his eyes, "So how did I get so lucky to get to spend my life with Paul?" It's so clear that John's sensitivity and his capacity for love were deeply rooted in your marriage. And we are so grateful for the ways that you have loved John and that you have shared him with us. John loved us. He cared so deeply about what each one of us might need to hear when we gather for worship. A word of consolation, a sign of hope, a sense of peace. And he knew that so often the Holy Spirit operates beyond words, through music, through presence, through silence. John knew that each of us has a unique way of experiencing God. What is meaningful for me might be unremarkable or even annoying for you, and vice versa. John knew that the practice of leaving our comfort zone and trying something new was essential to a growing and spirit-led community like this one. It helps break down barriers and build appreciation for one another. That's why he was so committed to such a wide variety of musical expressions. He wanted to make sure that there was something for everyone, for the person who'd been here forever, for the relative newcomer, to the person walking by on the street who had never stepped foot in a church. From the glory of a Bach cantata to the meditative repetition of a Taizé chant, from the driving rhythm of a rock Eucharist to the rich harmonies of Southern gospel, it was all a vehicle for people to experience something of God. You just want to give them a little bit of heaven. He said that all the time. That's what he'd say when he felt things had gone well and the music had flowed and the energy had been rich. He'd nod approvingly and say, "Just a little bit of heaven." This community was so important to John in building the music program, to its phenomenally vibrant and wildly talented present form, was perhaps his dearest and proudest accomplishment. John understood music ministry as just that, ministry. Not performance per se, but rather a spirit-led sharing of gifts offered freely and generously for the building up of the whole community. He invited, taught, and nurtured an entire generation of musicians, choristers, ministry students, priests, and lay leaders. He taught us to read scripture and to lead liturgy, grounded in the essentials, but open, so open to the leading of the Spirit. As good teachers often do, John spoke in parables, dropping stories and snippets of wisdom into everyday conversation. "So what do you think of?" fill in the blank. And as we would go back and forth on a topic, he'd slip in an opinion. But you knew you were in good stead if he nodded his head firmly and said, "Now that's fine." As in Mike and Will and the guys pulling together yet another amazing rock Eucharist. "That's fine." Or in the case of Jill recruiting top-notch string players for Bach Vespers, he'd say of Jill, "Isn't she solid?" Or of, say, Dan's ability to call upon section leads on short notice to create beautiful music for a funeral. He'd nod and say, "Now that's infrastructure." Fine. Solid. Infrastructure. Terms of highest praise. And his lower opinions were often delivered with a roll of the eyes. "For crying out loud," he'd say. Or with a sweep of the hand, "Oh, for heaven's sake." I remember John coming into the boardroom once for a staff meeting. He sat down at the table and looked at the stack of Holy Week leaflets on the table in front of him. He said to everyone, and to no one in particular, "Why are you untying the quilt?" And as everyone who's ever been to the early service on Good Friday knows, if anyone asks you, "Why are you untying the quilt?" you just tell them, "The Lord has need of it." It cracked me up. And ever since then, maybe a decade ago, when Holy Week rolls around, I got a text from John that says, "Why are you untying the quilt?" And of course I answer, "The Lord has need of it." Last year, I guess we were both busy because for the first time in a long time, Holy Week came and went. It wasn't until Easter Monday that I heard from John, "Do you think that quilt is still tied up?" The Lord has need of it. It was such a silly little exchange, but it says so much of how John operated in this world. We do things just because God needs us to do them. The kingdom of heaven is breaking in, and we all need to do our part through even the tiniest gesture of care or kindness to one another. John sensed when things were needed, and then also quietly he'd send something in your direction. "Do you need a desk?" he asked me once out of the blue. Maybe I'd mentioned something about a desk in my office that was sort of ramshackle and falling apart. "I have one for you," he said. "We're downsizing. Come and pick it up." I did. It was a beautiful mission-style desk. It's the nicest piece of furniture that I now own. I thanked him profusely, and of course he changed the subject. He wasn't one to wallow in thanks. Some years later, he mentioned to me, "You know, my grandfather made that desk." I've never known someone so grumpy and so generous all at once. So deeply generous. I remember him telling me about a conversation he had with his Aunt Isabel after she'd spent a year in an assisted living home with little contact with her church. John asked her if she still wanted to keep making her donation. And she said right away, "Yes, they need it more than I do. Besides, think of all the good they'll do with it." When John told me this story, he grinned and his eyes lit up and he said, "Now isn't that fine?" That's how John was too, with generosity. He could never pass up the chance for a random act of kindness. Decades after he'd left the Mormon church, if he spotted a pair of young fellows out on mission in their shirt sleeves and ties, he'd go up to them and say, "I used to be a Mormon," and he'd give them money for something to eat. The Lord has need of it. John rarely finished a conversation. He'd just sort of trail off, "Well, all right," and off he'd go, and he'd leave the door open for the next conversation. That was his way of keeping tabs on us. So many of us that he'd mentored over the years. Just a little comment, a link to a sermon, or maybe a YouTube video. Things he found interesting or funny, or things he just thought we might need to hear. After all, he fully expected us to go out and break into churches too. Especially these past months when John was in hospital, would go back and forth texting to pass the time. And he'd ask me questions about my everyday life. Remembrance Sunday. What did you do? Advent 1. What hymns did you sing? Which verses? As Christmas drew near, I asked him, well, what should I preach about on Christmas Day? This was his answer. Talk about the miracle that happened in the gifts, brought freely without reservation. How often do we do that? Give a gift without expecting one in return. And remind them that everybody was included, from a frightened Joseph to quaking shepherds. Everybody. There it was, John's theology in a nutshell. Miracles happening, gifts given freely. Everybody's included. This was followed right away by another text. Remember in the life of Brian when they went to the wrong house? That was how it was with John. Holy and hilarious, random and real. Back in late January, I got a text from John. Just a link, no comment. He sent it to Dan, too. It was a YouTube clip for a song from Taizé. And the words were, let all who are thirsty come. Let all who wish receive the water of life freely. Let all receive freely. You see, for John, it really all was for heaven's sake. The message he shared over and over, yours is the kingdom of heaven. It's yours, and yours, and yours. It's all of ours. And it's breaking in.